Magic Mike. We all cope with tragedy differently, and I don't think there's a right or wrong way to do it. My hope is we can all hold each other's hands throughout the sadness that life gives us and offer each other grace as we go through the process. Maybe that makes me seem like that character from Mean Girls who just wants to make a cake of rainbows for everyone, but it's how I feel. Our time is hard enough without the unexpected events that can break our spirits. It's important we all have shoulders to lean on, strength to keep moving forward, and friends to help us find the laughter when it feels impossible to smile. Leaving my family and friends in the Midwest when I entered adulthood was always a difficult decision for me. My parents live one street over from both my brothers and their families, and they all work together too, so me wanting to fly across the country to live my life never made much sense to them. Many of my childhood friends have also set up shop in Ohio, so it becomes a challenge to keep in touch with them while I live in California. Part of me always figured I would end up back there after a few years of adventures in my 20s and 30s, and while I still haven't decided to make the move back, I do find time to spend with my loved ones, usually meeting in Las Vegas for debauched days in a casino. It's an easy 45-minute plane ride from Los Angeles, and flights from Ohio to Vegas are cheap, so it's convenient to meet people there, catch up for a few days, and then go back to the real world. One of my lifelong best friends, Katie, now lives in Columbus, Ohio, but in 2017, we decided to have a renaissance in Sin City. She's a nurse, and my schedule is all over the place, so we weren't able to do a proper weekend. Instead, we planned to fly in on a Sunday and have 3 nights together in a cheap hotel room. We had aspirations of sitting at a slot machine, drinking countless vodka sodas, and eating at buffets. What we got was quite different. I was first to arrive Sunday morning, while Katie's flight was due to get in early afternoon, so I had time to check into our hotel at Planet Hollywood on the Strip, get some lunch, and unwind. I don't want to spend too much time gambling. Let's see a show tonight to keep us off the tables. Can you check to see what tickets are available? Katie asked me over the phone from the airport. Sure, I said before heading to the hotel concierge. On my way downstairs, I browsed one of those pamphlets I carried with me from the inside of a cab that listed every magician, comedian, pop star, and dance show on the Strip. It was an overwhelming selection. The concierge helped me out, telling me there were no divas, Mariah, Celine, or Britney, playing that Sunday night, but there were some hot tickets, namely Magic Mike Live, a country music festival, and a Cirque du Soleil-esque dance show. I was about to buy the country festival tickets for the both of us when Katie texted me that her flight was delayed. She wouldn't arrive at the hotel until around 7, so it'd be tough to make it to anything other than the late show of Magic Mike Live. Let's take a little detour. I love Magic Mike with all my heart and soul. Channing Tatum's performance as a male stripper was revolutionary, one of the greatest in the history of cinema. No man has ever moved on screen the way that he did, and I'm not sure any man will ever again. How the Academy didn't shower his finance with awards, I'll never know. Of course, I liked Chan when he burst onto the screen in the underrated Amanda Bynes vehicle, She's the Man, and the wonderful Step Up, but nothing could have prepared me for the magnetism that he would display as an exotic dancer who also made furniture and even did drag in that one random sequence in the first film. While I don't remember any plot points of that first movie, I do remember his pony dance, a sequence that will live rent-free in my mind for all of eternity. I'll be on my deathbed thinking of the subtle way he thrust his junk into the face of a blessed extra. His red thong should be hung in the Louvre, and dancing should be outlawed footloose style until every man can move like him. Magic Mike XXL, the second film, continued the story of Channing as Mike, and it's an almost flawless movie. My only complaint is that there isn't enough nudity for a stripper tale. My understanding is that women prefer the tease and don't want to see the full male body on display. I remember watching a segment on The View discussing the 50 Shades of Grey movies and how Jamie Dornan wasn't showing his full Peter Rabbit, while his female co-star Dakota Johnson showed her Meredith Grey, and the entire panel actually said on air that they didn't want to see his disco stick. The double standard was obvious to me, but the ladies argued that women weren't interested in seeing full penis. Many of my girlfriends feel differently, so I'm not sure I believe that. But I can tell you with 100% confidence that gay men do want to see the full male body on display. At the very least, we want to see Matt Bomer in a thong for multiple scenes and frames, and Magic Mike XXL didn't give us enough of that, in my opinion. Regardless, I hold both films to high esteem and will defend them to my death. Channing opted to take the Magic Mike film franchise to the stage, and not since The Lion King on Broadway has there been such a seamless film-to-stage adaptation. The idea that people could descend upon Vegas from all parts of the world and see this IP with the lax Vegas liquor laws is chef's kiss. I was excited for a night of abs with one of my very best friends. When Katie finally got to the hotel, there was just enough time for her to shower and shove some food in her mouth before we headed to the Hard Rock Hotel for the Hot Naked Men show. The cocktails started flowing the moment her suitcase was wheeled into our room, so we were nicely lubricated by the time we got to the ticket will call. The show started beautifully, with sexy lighting and a server who took our drink orders before we even sat in our seats. We opted to get the fishbowl-sized vodka sodas, reasoning that we had already started drinking hard liquor, so even though the glasses were big enough to house a living creature, at least we weren't mixing different types of alcohol like wine or beer. I'm here to tell you that no one actually needs a drink that big. You might think you do, but you don't. Never. There's no occasion where that makes sense. Just have one human-sized drink and then order another if you're still thirsty or not buzzed enough. A fishbowl should be for fish, not vodka, but I'm 100% certain that I will again make the same mistake in the future. Drinks were flowing so freely that I couldn't tell you if there was a storyline on stage or if the men were simply taking off their blouses for the audience to ogle. I blacked out the details, but I do remember the men were gorgeous, and the hostess gave everyone in the audience paper money that was like Monopoly dollars, only instead of buying hotels for Boardwalk Empire, you used it to make it rain on a man whose baby maker you wanted to see up close and personal. I also remember the crowd, filled with women and gay men hooting and hollering in a way that can only be described as unspeakably horny. If straight men had any sense, they don't, they would hang outside the venue waiting for the show to end because everyone's motor is running during Magic Mike Live. There's no easy way to transition here, but about 3/4 of the way through the show, just when Katie and I were starting to see double and order triples, I got a text from a friend who lived in the area. Her husband is a police officer in Las Vegas, and she said that he just got word that there was an active shooter on the strip. News like that is sobering, to say the least. The woman next to me was shouting, "Show me your dick," at a dancer while I was trying to read a terrifying, albeit blurry to my drunk eyes, text. I showed Katie and neither one of us knew exactly how to react. "Should we leave?" I asked Katie. "I'm sure it's nothing. Let's just get another drink," she replied, waving down our server for another fishbowl. I texted my friend for more details, put my phone in my pocket, and continued waving paper money at the nearest topless man. News like that is often hard for me to digest, and I naively assumed it was all an over-exaggeration or misreported. Surely it was nothing, because nothing bad like that ever happens in Vegas, a place of pure adult joy, right? We put reason aside and finished the show. As soon as we exited the dark lights of the theater, we knew something was really wrong. We all, unfortunately, now know how the evening ultimately played out, but at the time, things weren't so clear. Casinos are always a little hectic, but word was traveling fast that there was an active shooter nearby, and everyone in the casino was visibly terrified. While the Hard Rock Hotel is off the strip and far away from Mandalay Bay, where the shooting took place, there wasn't a lot of concrete info as to what was actually happening. People were running around, scared, some yelling, others telling people that there were attacks at other casinos. Our first instinct was to get a hotel room at Hard Rock, as we didn't want to go closer to where this was all happening, in case that would put us in more danger. It seemed like the best course of action was to stay put in one spot, away from the crowds. The line for reservations filled up quick, but we were able to book one of the remaining open rooms. Next, we went to the gift shop to get some essentials for the night. We wouldn't know how long we would be in our room, so we grabbed the basics. Toothbrushes, contact lens solution, and because we were hammered, snacks upon snacks upon snacks. All the while, pure chaos erupted around us. As I waited in line, I called my parents, who were asleep. I told them to turn on the news and promised them that Katie and I would go to our room and keep them posted when we knew more. Texts started coming in from friends and family who knew we were both in town. I texted back everyone I could, letting them know I was fine and at a hotel. Katie, drunk as she was, decided to post on social media to let her network of people know she was okay before her phone battery died. It would have made sense for her to update her Facebook status or her Twitter feed with something like, "I'm okay, we'll check in when I know more." But she had deleted Facebook and Twitter a few days earlier, so Instagram was the only platform at her disposal. Obviously, you have to post a picture on Instagram, so she couldn't just update the caption with her whereabouts. While I would have opted to post a Notes app update or a blank screen with information in the caption, Katie uploaded the most recent photo in her camera roll, which happened to be an accidental screenshot of her iPhone screen. She posted it with the caption, "My only form of social media at this point. Phone is about to die. I'm safe. At the Hard Rock Hotel in Vegas. I'll contact loved ones when I can." Almost immediately, her phone battery ran out, and since we didn't have chargers at our new hotel, that was the last communication we had with people. That accidental screenshot was all people saw throughout the entire night. In the screen grab, you can see an email she got from Zazzle and another from Groupon. Comments immediately flooded in underneath the photo, people saying things like, "What the F is this photo?" or "Is that an email from Zazzle?" as they tried to extract extra meaning behind Katie's picture during such a tumultuous time. In the gift shop, I grabbed every Kit Kat they had, paid, and went straight to our room. The tragic events were not happening where we were exactly, but again, we didn't know anything other than what people were saying on the casino floor. In our new hotel room, we put on the news and watched in horror as the events unfolded so closely to us and new information trickled out. I'll never understand how anyone could be so heartless, so evil. Everything that transpired sobered us up, so we didn't wake up the next day still tipsy like we normally would have. We exited the Hard Rock Hotel that next morning, and the Vegas Strip felt like a ghost town. Normally, the street is bustling at every hour with people, laughing and smiling or angry about the money they lost at the craps table. Instead, a sense of sadness filled the city. A former adult Disneyland was now a place of lingering devastation. Even as sadness filled the air for lives lost, there was a sense of perseverance that permeated the city. Video billboards that once advertised Boys to Men and Carrot Top were now showing Vegas strong, reminding residents and visitors that it will get through the darkness. It was non-negotiable. We were like zombies walking through the motions that next day, thinking of how easily it could have been us at that concert, and thinking about how those people who died were just looking for some time away with their best friends. Katie and I contemplated flying to our respective homes early, but that didn't quite feel right. It might be years before we were able to spend quality time together again, and there was a comforting collective mourning that was happening in town that I'm not sure I can put into words. I wonder if the people who think anyone should be able to own an assault rifle would still feel that way if they were able to be in Las Vegas that morning. Maybe they would think differently if they could feel the unspeakable loss that hung in the air. With our trip still in progress and every live show canceled on Monday night, we decided to order some drinks to the room and try to have a dance party. To be honest, we didn't know what to do. Maybe it was inappropriate of us to dance? We had spent the day tense and sad. I'm not a religious person, but I prayed for all the lives lost and the families who were finding out that they had lost loved ones. In our hotel room, we put on the TV and every channel was dedicated to the events of the night before. I felt helpless and trapped in sorrow. Grey's Anatomy has taught me that dancing it out is self-care, so we put on Mariah Carey and did our best to lift our spirits as much as we could. Eventually, we made our way to the casino floor, where many others were trying to force on a smile just as we were. Slots and blackjack only did so much, and we needed to do something to get our minds off the events. Enter a psychic. Psychics have long fascinated me, usually from a distance. It seemed like a fun, spontaneous thing to take our minds off the sadness. Katie felt similarly, and although we thought it would be easy to find one in Vegas, it turns out there aren't a ton on the Strip. We sat at a casino bar, scrolling the internet on our phones for the closest clairvoyant. I'm going to run to the restroom, I said to Katie. By the time I got back a few moments later, Katie had already booked us an appointment and ordered a car that would take us off the strip. Way off. The drive to our reading was almost an hour. We ended up in a small town outside of Vegas, empty and desolate, pulling up to a small apartment complex with no streetlights and very little sign of life. We should have turned right around, but instead we got out of the car and Katie texted the woman she had been communicating with, who was set to give us a reading. The woman, who told us her name was Zelsius with an X, led us into her home where Fox News was playing on the TV in her living room for her daughter, who looked roughly 10. You first, Zelsius said to Katie, bringing her into her bedroom as I sat on the couch in her living room. How we just went along with all of this is beyond me. There were so many red flags, reasons we should have bounced, but we did whatever Zelsius told us. Rather than make small talk with the child who was watching Tucker Carlson, I decided to get on my phone, text friends, and take some photos of our whereabouts. I thought it was important to document the occasion, not just for safety, but so future me could remember what was happening this night, as I would surely try to block it out of memory. Katie finished up, and Zelsius asked me to step in her room. I'm gay, I shouted as I entered, a fight-or-flight response in an effort to erase any potential sexual tension that could arise as she asked me to sit on her bed for the reading. I was wearing a Britney Spears shirt and a light layer of concealer, so there's little reason to think that she wouldn't have known I was homosexual, but I told her anyway. As I sat on her bed, my faith in her psychic abilities was non-existent. I wanted to get in and get out, satisfied that Katie and I would have this batshit story without needing any sort of tarot card thing. You have a show, she said, eyes closed while holding my hand. That show is going to grow. You'll have celebrity guests and go on the road. It will open many doors for you, she continued. I thought it was all bullshit. I left the room, rolling my eyes for only Katie to see, and politely smiled at Zelsius as we left her apartment. Did you tell her I started a podcast? I asked Katie. No, why would I talk to a psychic about a podcast? She countered. Our effort to take our minds off the grief fell flat, and the whole psychic experience made me feel gross. Gross that we had spent so much money, gross that we drove so far for so little, and gross that we were on this trip in the first place when tragedy struck so many people. There was also an air of guilt that we were able to continue when so many others were no longer afforded the opportunity. We both looked out our windows on our ride back to the strip, thinking about everything that transpired over our two nights. A tear flowed out of my eye, a culmination of every emotion, and then unexpectedly I heard Katie laugh. Not just any laugh, it was the laugh I first fell in love with when we met as young teenagers, familiar, warm, and infectious. It was the chuckle that I remember hearing at 14 when we went on a student council trip, and the one I remember hearing at 18 when we got tipsy after our high school graduation. Before the tear could even dry on my cheek, I joined her, laughing for the first time since we arrived. I wasn't sure what I was initially even laughing at, but it happened, and it was the church giggles, the kind of laugh you know that you shouldn't be participating in, but trying to stop it only makes you laugh even more. The sad tears and the happy tears combined into a release. The rest of the car ride was filled with those laughs, the kind only two close friends find together that you would never be able to explain to anyone else. We laughed at Katie's absurd and inappropriate Instagram post and at our ridiculous psychic visit. We laughed and laughed and laughed. When we planned our trip, we expected to have a traditional visit, slots, booze, and shows. We had all those things, but it was anything but traditional. Every time I had a milestone with my podcast, I thought about the tarot cards and the prediction, and in turn, Katie. I'm still not sure I believe in Zelsius, but I believe in the power of a renaissance, reuniting with an old friend for a fun time. So many lives were horrifically lost in that shooting, 60 in total. Countless friendships broken, robbed of the kind of laughs we were so fortunate to have on our ride back to the hotel. My heart will forever hurt thinking of the people who were tragically killed and the loved ones they left behind. But if you're listening to this and thinking of your Katie, a person you don't get to see as much as you want, I'm here to remind you to book that trip. Meet them somewhere and make some memories while you still can, because you never know when you won't be able to anymore. Life is hard and short, and in the end, those friendships are all we have. The tooth cleaning. Oops. Kim Richards, The Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. Who among us hasn't stress-eaten a full bag of caramels during a presidential debate? I certainly have, and while I was eating during the last election, I noticed something loose in my tooth. Rather than stop chewing on the hell candy, I decided to eat more and hope the next caramels I shoved in my mouth would somehow adhere to the loose item in my mouth to whatever it was loose from. The mechanics of my decision-making weren't quite worked out, but whatevs, I'm a dummy sometimes. I have to go to the dentist. My tooth fell out, I shouted at my boyfriend at 11 p.m. It's fine, it's just your filling. But it looks just like a whole tooth. It's supposed to look like your teeth, he said. While he was trying to calm me down, I used my tongue to inspect the area. I took great care of my chompers, save for binging candy when I'm emotional, and I've never had braces or a retainer. The one filling I did have was done at such a young age, I had forgotten it was even a thing. My fear led me to the internet, which can be an incredibly dangerous place. I get myself into enough trouble when I'm on eBay buying Space Jam merch or looking for rare Tiny Toons Happy Meal toys from my youth, but I'm a whole other level of dangerous when I'm Googling symptoms or ailments. A mere moment went by before I found myself on a message board for mouth care. Someone on the page suggested that when a filling falls out, you should wrap it up and bring it to the dentist, so I immediately put it in a tissue and took an old Xanax that I found in the medicine cabinet so I could fall asleep. The next morning, I called my dentist and told them it was an absolute emergency. It wasn't. Keep in mind, it was fall of 2020 when COVID-19 and the election were in full swing. Emotions were high, and I hadn't communicated much with people in person most of the year. Going to the dentist was one of the few times I left the house aside from going to the grocery store, so I put on my finest wares and made it a special event. There was a new button-down I had bought right before quarantine, so I threw that on, tossed my dead filling in my shirt pocket, gelled my hair, and pressed my pants. I looked like $1 million. My dentist took a quick look at my teeth and suggested refilling without any need for my old one, so that old tooth-like thing I had wrapped in a tissue the way my grandma used to wrap a half-eaten cough drop was sitting tight in my shirt. The doc finished up the work on my mouth and I headed back home. A few days later, I decided to run some errands. There was a tote bag of clothes that I wanted to take to the dry cleaners and some mail I had to drop off at the box, so I gathered my things and left the house. Going anywhere during the first year of the pandemic was a challenge, navigating new rules and guidelines at places you've been 100 times. At the dry cleaners, they put those little feet stickers on the ground indicating where to stand in line, so you'd always be at least 6 feet away from the other customers. I hopped onto one of those stickers behind an older woman with kind eyes and what looked like 17 pillowcases she was having dry cleaned, and in front of an older gentleman I could tell was gay because we were in West Hollywood, and he also had a tote bag with two cartoon men kissing on it, and literally it said, "I'm a big gay," in bold letters. I wish I knew where he got that bag. The woman in front of me finished up and I started walking to the register, simultaneously pulling out my clothes to present to the cashier. As I yanked the shirts out of my bag, the old filling I had forgotten was wrapped in a tissue in one of the pockets got loose and floated to the floor of the dry cleaners. As I bent down to grab it, I saw the tooth-like filling roll out of the tissue and tumble to the feet of the old man with the horny tote. Instinctively, he picked up the filling and reached his hand out toward me as his eyes began to inspect what was now in his hands in the midst of a global pandemic. "What's this?" he said as his arm extended into the 6-foot radius measured out for me by the dry cleaners. "That's my old tooth filling," I responded. Color immediately escaped this man's face like Reese Witherspoon in the movie Pleasantville, as if he just saw a ghost. His hand nervously tossed my old mouthpiece into the air as he let out a scream that can only be described as a turkey running for freedom on Thanksgiving morning. As the filling drifted in the wind, the woman that had once been in front of me in line was now dodging the loose tooth figurine like she was Keanu Reeves in The Matrix, or Ghostface dodging a saucer that Anna Faris's character threw at him in the scary movie scene that parodies The Matrix. Under normal circumstances, I would have pushed everyone aside so I could grab the item, then put it in my pocket, run out of the establishment, and cry in the shower while listening to a Mary J. Blige ballad. But this was a pandemic. I had to keep a social distance. The filling then hit the ground for a second time, and I got on my hands and knees, but it continued to roll away from me. I could only assume they had waxed the floors right before my visit because that thing was moving faster than lightning. Eventually, I caught up to it and let out a sigh of relief. "Oops, forgot that was in my shirt pocket," I said to the other patrons, who looked at me like I was crazed. Since I'd already embarrassed myself, I figured I might as well get my clothes cleaned. I dragged my belongings to the register and unloaded my clothes on the counter with the dead filling tightly in my grasp so it wouldn't do any more bouncing. "Just the 6 shirts and 2 pairs of pants, ready by Friday would be great," I informed the cashier. "You don't have any other teeth in the pockets, do you?" she asked. "No, just the one, and it was just a filling." She handed me a receipt and I started to walk toward the door with my head down, horrified. I glanced up at the old man. He lifted his mask and smiled. It wasn't a happy smile. He grinned just enough so I could see mouth. "Dentures," he said. "You're lucky you have teeth to fill. Always count your blessings." How can we be lovers? Music is like a time machine that can transport us to specific moments in life. I did dinner theater in Chicago, and every time I hear YMCA, I'm suddenly in the Windy City. The beautiful 8-bit sounds of Super Mario Brothers can take me back to Christmas morning 1990, and when I hear the Mulan soundtrack, the sadness of my middle school years washes over me, and I'm standing with my choir teacher who took away my "I'll Make a Man Out of You" solo moments before the choral concert. My college years are loaded with special songs, one in particular that will always hold a special place in my heart and emotionally carry me right back to my freshman year. When I arrived in Athens, Ohio for my first year of college, I was excited to start fresh. Even though Athens is a small town, it was a big city to me. I had spent my entire life in a suburb of Cleveland, so going to the other side of the state felt like a huge deal. Plus, Love and Basketball was one of my favorite movies, so despite not playing a sport or having a significant other, I was delighted to enter the dramatic third quarter portion of my life, like Quincy and Monica did when they got to college. All I was missing was a meal card, a girlfriend, I was still in the closet, and a tiny basketball hoop in my dormitory to play strip basketball. I eventually got the meal card. One of the requirements my freshman year was to take a language course. I chose American Sign Language, or ASL, hoping to better connect with a new friend who was deaf. The class pre-final went by swimmingly. The professor was a woman in her 40s who was tough and intelligent, but she didn't seem to have a funny bone in her body. I tend to find the humor in everything, and this woman never cracked a smile. Not a chuckle to be found within spitting distance of this woman. She was like an episode of Homeland. People who don't have a sense of humor leave me uneasy, but my grades were consistently good throughout the year, and I proved to myself I had the ability to learn another language. It may sound stupid, but it felt like a new world opened to me. Plus, one of my new besties, Jenny, was in the class with me. Because I was thriving, I got maybe a little too comfortable in the class. Some confidence is good, but too much can lead you down a bad path. Toward the end of the year, the professor dropped the bomb on us. "For the final exam, you must sign a children's book in front of the class," she said. I turned to Jenny and we began spitballing book ideas. She mentioned Dr. Seuss while I wondered if Where the Wild Things Are would be too long for a presentation. As we were talking, another student raised their hand. "Do we have to do a book?" he asked. "You can do a song, just bring in the music and you can sign along with it." Music seemed like more work, so I shrugged it off and thought about more book ideas. We had a week before the presentation, so I figured I would go to the library and find something easy that would also impress. Class ended that day, and Jenny and I headed straight back to the dorm rooms. Let's take a little detour. Dorm living is the best. My favorite part was the communal aspect of watching television. I'll never forget the entire floor watching the season 2 finale of Grey's Anatomy. Izzy and Denny had a love story for the ages. I could cry right now thinking of Katherine Heigl in a merlot-colored dress, cozying up to the dead body of Jeffrey Dean Morgan while Snow Patrol played in the background. BRB, going to get some tissues. And I'm back. Our dorm floor also loved American Idol. We kept a journal during the season, and we would write down all the batshit things Paula Abdul said after the performances. I personally don't think the show ever recovered from Paula's leave. That original panel was magic. Magic! I eventually returned to watch the Mariah Carey season, but nothing compared to Miss Abdul saying nonsensical things at young hopeful singers. Remember that time she critiqued a performance that had yet to happen on the live show? That moment is why I love television. When the other judges in Seacrest corrected her, she seemed stunned. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go YouTube it. I'm not saying she was a mess, but I am implying it. Anyway, back to my ASL class. This course was my last class of the day, so often Jenny and I would leave and meet up with friends for boozing. This particular night, we decided to do one of those power hours in the dorm. If you're not familiar, it's a drinking game where you listen to music and the song changes every 60 seconds. Each time it does, you drink. Someone had the bright idea to do it with liquor as a challenge, so every 60 seconds we would take a sip of the cheapest vodka we could find. I'm constantly concerned with gut health now that I'm in my 30s, but back then I would chug from a $9 liter of gas station liquor that tasted like old feet. By minute 50, we were wasted and singing at the top of our lungs. This particular power hour was a 90s theme, so every minute would be a different song from the era. One of the last was Michael Bolton's How Can We Be Lovers, which was released in 1990, so it just barely made the cut. It's one of those songs that not everyone necessarily loves, but everyone accidentally knows the lyrics to, like All Star by Smash Mouth. Jenny and I were singing along and having the best time when she joked that it would be funny if one of us performed it for the ASL final. We quickly laughed it off and finished the power hour. After the 60-minute mark, we all headed off to the bar. There was a place on campus that was 18 and over and known for being lax with fake IDs, so we spent most of freshman year there. They also had a pool table and jukebox that made it a welcoming establishment for the older townies, so it was great for people watching, too. When we got there, Jenny and I were just drunk enough to think we would have a successful pool game and also so drunk that we would actually have a terrible pool game. We had spent an hour consuming the foot vodka, so we racked the balls and decided to make things interesting. "What should we bet?" I slurred. "A bet, huh? How about whoever wins gets to pick what the other person does for their ASL final?" she replied. "Deal!" It's important to note that we could barely stand at this point, let alone play pool. I think it took us about an hour just to finish the game, and I looked like one of those inflatable tube men stationed in front of car dealerships as I waited my turn. Jenny won. As she was thinking about what song to make me sign for my ASL final, another friend was playing a song on the jukebox. It was Kaya's My Neck, My Back. "Do this song," Jenny shouted. Don't get me wrong, that song is a forever bop, but it's hardly appropriate to sign about a pussy and a crack in a classroom setting. "I can't do this. I'm not signing a song about my pussy and my crack," I reasoned. "But that's the bet. You lost, so you have to sign about your pussy and your crack," she replied. "I'm sorry, but it's too far. The professor will fail me the moment I sign about licking my..." "They play it on the radio," Jenny interrupted. "Not with the pussy and the crack in it. It's censored," I argued. "Forget it." "No, I lost the bet. Fair is fair. I'll do any song that doesn't have pussy and crack in it. Anything else." "Fine, then do the Michael Bolton song," Jenny said. "How Can We Be Lovers?" "Yeah, there are no swear words." "Deal, I'll do that one," I said. Eventually, we stumbled back to the dorms, our feet chaotically stomping around campus like two baby giraffes fresh out of the womb. The next morning, I woke up fresh as a daisy because youth. I spent the afternoon debating in my head if the Michael Bolton song would be appropriate to sign. The word lovers felt sort of weird, but again, at least it wasn't Kaya. I gave in and spent the week learning to sign it. Jenny and I eventually headed off to our ASL final. She had prepared One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish by Dr. Seuss, and I had memorized the power ballad about making love after making amends with a scorned partner. On the way, we theorized about what other students would do, figuring at least a few others would do music. We arrived at the classroom, and there were a bunch of older people who looked like my parents in the room. Seated in front of the adults, there were very young children, around age 6 to 8. I assumed either they or I had walked into the wrong classroom. The professor walked in and closed the door behind her. Apparently, I was in the right place, and so were all the adults and young children filling up the space. Welcome to the ASL final. Books away. Today, you will be signing your prepared children's story. I've brought in some guests to help judge your work, so please say hello to the Deaf Boys and Girls Club of Southeast Ohio, the professor said. Shit. I thought I'd be performing a Michael Bolton song for a classroom of college students, not six-year-olds. I was already on the fence about signing my chosen-for-me song, so I raised my hand to ask if I could do it privately. The professor pointed at me, and when I began to ask my question, she signed something back that I didn't understand in my anxiety haze. She said we're only to use sign for the remainder of the class, Jenny whispered. I can't sign Michael Bolton to a group of deaf children, I told her. I looked to my left and saw the smiling faces of kids ready to be entertained. The professor instructed the first student to stand and start. That young woman got up in front of the group and signed the Cat in the Hat. Another student followed with Good Night Moon. The man who asked about doing a song was next. My heart rate slowed as I anticipated his performance. Since he was the one who asked to do a song, surely he would be doing some pop music, right? He popped his CD into the CD player at the front of the room and signed along to Old MacDonald. Old MacDonald. What the fuck? I thought he would do a Ludacris song or maybe the Pussycat Dolls, something popular and on the radio at the time, not Old McMotherfucking Donald. Jenny went next and, of course, slayed her Dr. Seuss performance with ease. As Jenny was wrapping up, I wanted to leave my body. Remember that movie Under the Tuscan Sun with Diane Lane, where she escapes her existence and starts a new life in Tuscany? I was ready to run out of that classroom and buy a villa. If only I had more than $7 in my bank account. It was so rude of Diane Lane to present that perfect film to us, knowing I couldn't afford to live out my own version of the story. Every other student signed a kid's book. Did no one else hear her say that we could do a song? Did she say only a nursery rhyme or book? I was sweating profusely and my heart was beating out of my chest. The only thing that calmed me down was knowing I wouldn't be signing about my pussy and my crack. Rather than risk failing the class, I went up to the stage. I went to the front of the classroom. I popped my CD in and waved to the children as the opening chords of Michael Bolton's How Can We Be Lovers began to play. When I looked up, I saw one of the parents smiling ear to ear before the lyrics even started. She was a good time gal, I could tell, and it comforted me imagining that she likely met one of her ex-husbands back in 1991 when she was drunk on whiskeys with a single splash of Diet Coke at a local dive bar. I could see on her face that the song brought back great memories for her. I like to think her birth name was Eleanor, but she changed it to Viper with a Y or Sprindell in the 80s. I wish I knew where Viper with a Y is now, but I digress. The other adults looked bewildered when the power ballad kicked into high gear. I began to sign alongside the big-haired crooner, trepidatious at first. One of the parents covered the eyes of her child, while another shook their head in disgust as I signed about lovers. By the second chorus, I was in the zone. I imagine it was how Queen Britney Spears felt when she performed songs off her album, In the Zone. For the most part, the children just looked grossed out and certainly didn't seem to enjoy it in the slightest. I once tried to watch the movie Donnie Darko at my friend's house, and his grandma decided to watch with us. It's a very dark, often confusing artistic film. She spent the first half hour looking at the screen the way someone looks at their spouse when that spouse farts in bed. That was basically how those kids looked at me, disgusted. Like they were my friend's grandmother, and I was the first half hour of Donnie Darko. I focused all my energy on Viper with a Y, pretending she was the only one in the room. I could see out of the corner of my eye that the youths did at least look like they understood the tale of a scorned lover who wondered aloud if he could continue a sexual relationship with someone he argued with all the time. I think it's because I committed to the bit. They tell me I can't recite the lyrics in this audiobook, so go ahead and take a beat to hop on Spotify and listen to the Michael Bolton song if you're unfamiliar. The Deaf Boys and Girls Club of Southeast Ohio witnessed something they likely did not expect when they arrived on campus that day. I'm certain those parents wouldn't let their kids step foot in a college classroom for years to come. As for myself, I pageant smiled through the remainder of the song with my head held high. I was proud I did such a good job despite the awkwardness. The professor, however, was horrified by my performance. She gave me a C-, telling me that she had to take off points for my misinterpretation of the assignment. I think she would have docked me more if she didn't know it was her own fault for not specifying that it had to be a kid-friendly song. I no longer remember how to sign the entire thing, but I can still do the chorus of How Can We Be Lovers. The experience taught me a valuable lesson about commitment. Sometimes we find ourselves in situations that are uncomfortable. 3 minutes and 55 seconds in front of a crowd can feel like a lifetime, but you'll eventually get to the end of the song, whether the children in the room like it or not. There are always going to be times that we want to run when life gets tough, and running is an option. You can head off to Tuscany and start a brand new life under that Tuscan sun, or you can see something through with a smile on your face and, hopefully, a woman like Viper with a Y in the audience. I think the most important thing I learned that day is to remember that life can always be worse. While I wish I would have signed a children's book and earned myself a higher letter grade, I'm so grateful that I didn't enter the classroom and sign about my pussy and my crack to the Deaf Boys and Girls Club of Southeast Ohio. Epilogue. What's going on with my career? Shares Twitter. I opened this audiobook talking about my adult journals and some of the ridiculousness found in the dried-up old pages. There was one entry from a particularly tough 2012 night that I thought I'd share as we wrap things up. It was years before my first entertainment gig. I hadn't made a penny off my writing, social media, or comedy, aside from a couple $100 I earned doing a dinner theater show in Chicago. I felt like I was struggling to keep my head above water while everyone else seemingly had the career of their dreams. They didn't, but truth never gets in the way of feeling sorry for oneself. Here's a piece from that entry. August 18. Dear Diary. Someone told me that I look tired today, but I'm not tired at all. It broke me. Oh, sorry, that's the wrong day. Here's the actual entry I was referring to. August 19. While my peers are finding success in areas they may not have initially been drawn toward, I'm stuck in limbo. When I left college, I didn't care that I was a struggling artist because my friends were also struggling to find jobs and make money. Now, those same people have risen in the ranks in their chosen professions. They have the money to go out to dinner when they want and buy clothes and nice things. I'm still wearing Old Navy hand-me-downs from a decade ago. They order steak and split checks evenly. I order a side salad with extra dinner rolls and have to pay my bills separately. They bring bottles of alcohol to share at house parties, and I'm like, I didn't have a full bottle to bring, so I just got drunk before I came. I'm embarrassed. I know that this is the price you pay for chasing dreams in your late 20s, but isn't that the point of all those movies we watched when we were 8? Why am I now the outcast for wanting something different in life? Friends and family are telling me to grow up, while they tell anyone under the age of 12 within spitting distance that they should never give up on their dreams. I used to visualize those dreams coming true, but the older I get, the blurrier that vision becomes. I still hope I'll get there, but I feel like I'm going through life with protective eyewear on, and the more time that goes by, the dirtier they get. I'm losing sight of the life I want, but I'm not prepared to take off the glasses. Is seeing the world without the protection of my own hopes and dreams worse than fighting through the fog? The entry reads like a low-budget Carrie Bradshaw, but I made it through that evening and I'm sharing in hopes that any of you who are feeling similarly might be able to fight through your own fog. I still don't have it all figured out, but I'm learning not to compare myself so much to other people. I'm not sure where I get off ending this as if it's some self-help guide instead of a collection of silly stories about Judy Garland and childhood trips to Florida, but when you finish this audiobook, I implore you to do the same. Just because your best friend is sharing pictures of their perfect kids or your cousin is posting about a fancy job promotion, that doesn't mean they have it all together. Whether you're 17 or 74, just keep on doing you. We all have similar experiences to help us relate to each other, but we're on our own journeys. And although time may have a way of stealing our happiness, try to remember those childhood moments when everything seemed possible. Recently, I went to a Los Angeles restaurant with a pop-up Instagram installation. People crowded around to take pictures for social media, crafting the perfect captions and using the photo to show off to all their friends online. A few days later, I flew to visit my family in Northeast Ohio, spending lots of time in early June with my nieces and nephews. As the sun set one night and an Old Faith Hill song played on an outdoor speaker, I watched the kids running barefoot and happy on the green grass, and I thought about all the times I spent as a child catching fireflies in old mayonnaise jars at dusk in the same place. I gathered all the youngsters for an Uncle Danny photo, and although it was hard to get everyone to look at the camera, the lightning bugs lit our smiles more perfectly than the manufactured twinkle lights that are strewn together on a restaurant Instagram set ever could. I often think about when I was their age, when my parents would assemble us in the unfinished basement before bed, and we would line up alongside the wall where there was a rickety piece of lumber barely attached to a doorway. My brothers and I would lean up against it one by one to mark our height. I would wear extra socks or stand on my tippy toes to gain a few extra centimeters. Dad would draw a line on the wood with a pen while Mom would tell him the date to write above the measurement. This repeated once a year or whenever they would remember to corral us in the lower level. Our family of five gathered to mark time in between basketball practices, second jobs, mortgage payments, and puberty. That is, until we grew taller than the loose piece of timber. One by one, we moved out of the house we grew up in and started our own families. My parents knew back then that life moves so quickly we must take a moment to acknowledge where we're at and look back at how far we've come. I tried my best to appear a little bit taller, to rush time, but now I'd give anything to go back and relive one of those nights exactly where I was, surrounded by the people I love most in a moment that was ours, when everything seemed possible. I hope that one day my nieces and nephews will hear that same Faith Hill song, think about those nights catching glowworms and feel the same, yearning to go back to a beautiful moment in time. Nostalgia is a hell of a drug, and although it's important to live in the now, I love knowing I have a bank of experiences I can escape to when the present is too much to handle. The reason I love 90s and early aughts pop culture so much is because it helps me with my great escape, allowing me to time travel to those happy moments as often as I want. The things we look back on from our youth are more than just music, movies, TV shows, or toys. They are the quickest road to nostalgia, one of the easiest ways to recapture the feelings we had when we were our most innocent and optimistic selves, and the closest thing to getting into a time machine alongside Doc Brown. My podcast usually ends by doing a little breathing exercise and sharing some cheesy motivational words. We get so caught up in our day-to-day that we forget to take a moment to catch our breath. So breathe in and breathe out. Measure your life not by the markings on the wood, but by the memories there within. Let the fireflies guide you through the fog, reminisce in the quiet of your mind, look back at how far you've come, and embrace the nostalgia. It's hard to unremember the bad in life, but the good is a flashback away, and the sun will always rise to remind us that new memories start with the shine of the morning rays and continue through dusk. Acknowledgements. I know you thought you were done with this audiobook, and you mostly are. However, I wanted to do a little acknowledgement section where I thank all the people who helped make this a reality. And I decided the acknowledgement section deserved a little detour of its own. This whole project wouldn't have been possible without my podcast audience, and my podcast wouldn't have happened without all the hours I've clocked watching talk shows. Ever since I could remember, I've loved the talk interview format. As a little boy growing up in Northeast Ohio, movies and television seemed less like a potential career path and more like a distant planet that I could never inhabit. Even so, I was enamored by the lifestyles of actors and musicians. Not only did it seem like they had all the money in the world, but also they got to create the things I loved most, movies. I watched stars talk about their latest work, and I dreamed of a different world, one filled with the magic of Hollywood that polished all of life's flaws and presented them in a pretty package. The guests were my way in, but I quickly fell more in love with the hosts of those talk shows. When I was really young, my mom used to have Regis and Kathy Lee on in the morning, and I would marvel at their banter before school. Regis always knew how to find the punchline, unafraid to poke fun at himself in the process, while KLG had a unique ability to be silly one moment and serious the next without missing a beat, something she later honed even more with Hoda, who herself has such an obvious kindness in her soul that shines through the TV. Kelly Ripa would take over for Kathy Lee in 2001, and she had and continues to have such an effortlessly fun attitude. A lot of people praised Kelly's chemistry with Regis, but I think she could make chemistry with a cantaloupe if she had to. She's wildly charming. I've always just wanted to hang out with Kelly, and to this day, even though she has tons of success, I'm not sure she's appreciated for just how phenomenal she is at her job. Earlier, I mentioned the Rosie O'Donnell Show, and there was a time when Rosie completely took over daytime. She was everything to me. Everything. Her love of pop culture and celebrity made me feel seen. Barbara Streisand, Mary Tyler Moore, Bette Midler, and more would guest, and Rosie would gush, unafraid to fangirl on air in front of millions of people. She was a pop culture junkie just like us. When she would sit down at that desk and talk about the TV she watched the night before or the musical theater she took in, I felt like she was a bestie talking directly to me. She was a way for me to see Broadway shows without ever traveling to NYC and the first influencer in my life. The Rosie O'Doll plush she released during the 90s, along with the Rosie Barbie, are both nestled safely in my office. But whatever she would promote, I would want, whether it be the toys and koosh launchers she showcased on her desk, a book of punny jokes, a Tickle Me Elmo, or even her two holiday albums. That's right, Rosie made two Christmas albums just like my other faves, Mariah Carey and Jessica Simpson, icons only. My mom liked Rosie, Regis, Kathy Lee, and Kelly, but Oprah was her number one. I've since gone back and watched old episodes of The Oprah Winfrey Show, stunned at how she could be so intelligent while simultaneously being relatable and down to earth. The variety in those Oprah episodes is also something to be studied. One day we'd be watching her take a camping trip with Gail, the next she'd be talking to Julia Roberts, and later in the week there would be an hour on 9/11. Of course, we all also remember her Favorite Things episodes, which I still watch yearly, along with her Legends Ball. One week when I had the flu recently, I watched the reality show she did for OWN about the making of the final season. It was so fascinating that I immediately started the series over to watch a second time right after I finished it. There will never be another Oprah. Speaking of doing it all, I'd be remiss not to mention the greatest entertainer of all time who also happened to be a popsicle stick, Stick Stickley. Stick was a Nickelodeon staple, and although not as respected as some of the other journalists here, I think about him all the time. It's a good reminder to all artists that you can be super creative with very few resources. You don't need a huge budget or A-list celeb guests to have a successful talk show. Googly eyes and a smile are enough. In college, I became obsessed with The View, which I still watch every single day. Although it started long before my freshman year, Rosie's first tenure is what got me into it, and I believe the infamous split screen with Elizabeth Hasselbeck is one of the greatest hours of television of all time, regardless of genre. It was clearly difficult for the women to live through, but the tension is something scripted dramas could only dream of. "Go to commercial!" Joyce shouted as I sat on the edge of my seat. Most people are familiar with the fight, but I also hop on YouTube from time to time to rewatch the segment that happened after the split screen. Alicia Silverstone was there to talk about being a vegan, and she comes on stage moments after Rosie and Elizabeth had an intense back and forth about loyalty in the Iraq war. Alicia is visibly shook, out of breath, and unsure of herself. Ever the professionals, Joy, Sherry, who was filling in that day, Rosie, and Elizabeth all act as if it was all just a normal episode of television. It's fascinating. I stuck with The View after Rosie left the first time, staying glued to the screen even during the Jenny McCarthy years. Some of the panels have been better than others, and it usually is reflected in the ratings, but I still love all the women who have sat at that table. With the rise of social media, I notice more and more people take to Twitter to voice their outrage at whoever is in the cast that they disagree with. But the truth is that show works best when there are a variety of voices for hot topics. I may not agree with the resident conservatives, but I recognize how important they are to make that hour succeed. There was a brief moment where they had a panel who mostly saw eye to eye, and the hot topics leaned more toward pop culture than politics, which didn't make for a good show. Certain hosts deserve more, hashtag justice for Michelle Collins, while others overstayed their welcome. But The View remains an institution, and I hope to still be watching a hologram of Whoopi, Joy, and the rest of the panel when I'm old and gray, getting fired up at whoever it is that I love to hate at the table. For some reason, men and women tend to be separated in the talk show space. Women largely occupy the daytime hours while males fill up the late night spots, which is unfortunate. Bonnie Hunt was a revelation in the afternoon for a couple of seasons, but I always thought she was too quick-witted for daytime, her jokes flying over the heads of people watching in the afternoon as they got dinner ready. I wish a network had given her a shot at a night spot when the audience is more concentrated on the material. I'd also love her to do more acting. Quite frankly, I just want more of her warm-hearted Midwest energy and humor wherever I can get it. These days, I tune into Andy Cohen before bed. His beautifully random mix of celebrity on Watch What Happens Live is soothing to me. Where else on TV can you see Sheena from Vanderpump Rules alongside a CNN news anchor for an entire half hour? There are a lot of great new hosts, people who offer their own blend of brilliance and fun. Kelly Clarkson is, to me, one of the greatest vocalists of our time, and I can't believe I live in a world where I get to hear her perform a cover song every single day on her talk show. We also get Drew Barrymore's Sunshine Daily and the ability of Wendy Williams to captivate an audience the way she does for 20-some minutes at the top of every show by herself is inspiring. The point is, I love talk shows. I find myself in YouTube spirals at night watching old interviews, studying how Larry King would navigate his chats, seeing how Donnie and Marie hosted as a duo, and being blown away by Katie Couric's ability to cover both hard news and fluff pieces. When I decided to do my podcast, Everything Iconic with Danny Pellegrino, I didn't quite have the resources at my disposal to put on a huge show. As an independent production, I literally lost money the first 2 years, and in order to book guests, I had to plead with celebrities in their DMs. I wasn't backed by a network and had just a small social media following. I did, however, have all the lessons that I learned from my talk show heroes, and I truly believe that's what led to the show's success. Over the years, I've gotten the chance to chat with some of the hosts that I've admired from afar, something that I never could have imagined when I was that little boy in Ohio. Rosie O'Donnell, Katie Couric, Andy Cohen, Kathy Lee Gifford, Marie Osmond, Bonnie Hunt, Drew Barrymore. I've been fortunate enough to interview all of these talk show legends, and the one constant I've noticed in each of them is a warm spirit. They know how to make you feel like a friend, and I hope that when people listen to my show or listen to this audiobook, they think of me as one and know that I think of you all as mine. Our worlds can be so lonely, but television, film, podcasts, and books are so important because they make us feel connected to the people around us, especially at times when we might be isolated. Compared to these network juggernaut shows, my little podcast is inconsequential, but I feel incredibly proud of the work I've done. The fact that I've had the opportunity to talk to some of these people means the world to me because it's my childhood dreams realized. One of the best sleeps of my life was the night after I interviewed Rosie, and that's because a goal that swirled in my head every night when I hit the pillow was finally checked off my list. There's a power that comes with making a dream a reality, and I'll continue to fantasize, but for now, I want to say that I'm grateful for the lessons I've learned along the way, the talk show greats who have inspired me over the years, and most importantly, all of the people who listen, read, and follow. Actual acknowledgements. Okay, here are the actual acknowledgements. This book is a dream come true, and I'm forever grateful to everyone who helped make it a reality. This little section might be gross to hear, so I'm sorry in advance. Just turn it off if you're not interested. This is your warning. Turn it off. Also, why do I always feel the need to apologize for everything? Sorry for saying sorry so much. First and foremost, I want to thank my friends and family featured in the book. You're all super special to me, and I apologize if I got something wrong or upset any of you within the pages or within the audiobook. It all comes from a place of love and admiration for all of you who have shared these stories with me. My agent, Kristen Keene-Benton, is simply the best. Kristen, you believed in this and me from the beginning. You're amazing, and I thank you for fighting for me and my vision for this book. Kate Roddy, my editor at Source Books, thanks for understanding me and this project. I loved working with you and everyone else at Source Books. Kate, you were patient, kind, and helped elevate the book beyond my wildest expectations. You also made me look like a better writer, so I thank you for the beautiful editing work. My ICM team, you're the best, and specifically thanks to Brittany Perlmutter for always listening to me vent. Thank you to the Riker brothers for taking the beautiful cover photo of me. I'm honored to call you both friends. Mom and Dad, I love you both more than I can express in words. I hope you're not too mad about anything I wrote in here. You're the best parents a person could ask for. Mom, you have the biggest heart in the world, and I'm honored to be slowly morphing into you as I get older. You're my favorite person of all time. And Dad, you've taught me so many invaluable lessons about hard work and determination. This project wouldn't have come to fruition without the lessons you taught all of us about not giving up and always believing in yourself. Brian and Junior, I'm so glad I got to experience my childhood with the two of you by my side. I've always felt protected by your love and guidance. I'm just super lucky to have two big brothers who I know will always have my back. Taryn and Samantha, I love you. I'm thrilled my brothers found such great women to join the family. Anthony, Bella, Sophia, Brady, and Beckham, when you're old enough to read this, which isn't for a little while, I hope you enjoy it and one day share your own Pellegrino memories. I love you, and I'm always here when you need me and when you don't. Speaking of Pellegrinos, I've always had a deep connection with my Grandma Rose, but it wasn't until I sat down to write this book that I realized just how important she was to me and continues to be. She always found the good in people and led with kindness. Writing about my relationship with her provided closure that I didn't even know I needed, and I hope I go forward carrying a small part of her beautiful heart in mine. My Grandma Sophie was also very important to me, the other side of the coin. I'll consider myself lucky to be even a tiny bit like her going forward. The two of them were the absolute best life has to offer. Matt, you're my other favorite person in the world. I love you. I know I should say some specific things about you here, but there are too many things I like about you. I suppose I'm most grateful that I not only love you with all my heart, but that I also like you so much too. And special thanks for all the amazing graphics you created for this project. And thanks to Mama P for being so wonderful. Baby girl, Jill, thanks for being my best friend and always believing in me, even in those moments I didn't always believe in myself. From our high school talent show to now, you've always been by my side cheering me on. Everyone needs a number one, and you're that for me. XOXO. Beth and Jude, you're always in my heart. I think back to all the times we would drive around together and talk about our hopes and dreams for the future. I'm grateful you both remained a part of my future, and I'm happy to know you always will. Katie B., thanks for letting me share a piece of our story. I love you so much, and you too, Tina D., for always. We need another Renaissance soon. Jenna Brister, I'm so grateful to have you in my creative circle. You're incredibly smart, kind, and creative. I love being able to bounce things off you. Love you. Hannah Brown, thanks so much for reading my work before it was work. I'm so grateful for our friendship. Bob Harper, thank you for giving me a chance to be a writer when you hired me for your book. I learned so much about publishing. You opened a new world for me and took a chance on someone when you certainly didn't have to. Also, thank you for the author photo. I've been fortunate enough to have some really great teachers in life, both in school and out. To all the people who taught me in a classroom and made me want to read and write, thank you. Teachers are wildly underappreciated, and I want to express appreciation from the bottom of my heart. From Mrs. Fabian in kindergarten teaching me the basics of kindness, to Mrs. Cozell in middle school teaching me not to start sentences with the same word, Jill Frimmel Harvey for encouraging me to lead in high school, and Andrea Vecchio for being a great boss at a very impactful morning show internship at WKYC in Cleveland. Andy Cohen, thank you for all the beautiful Bravo work you do and for encouraging me to find a home for this book. I was ready to give up, and you gave me kind words when I needed them most. Mariah Carey, I love you. Forever is my personal favorite song of yours because it has special meaning to me, but everything you've written and performed is iconic, and I need you to know how much I love you. If by some crazy, insane chance you ever pick up this book. While we're here, I'd like to thank the entire cast and crew of VH1's Divas Live 1998 and 1999. Fozzie Bear, you're my first comedic influence and I will forever stan. Nora Ephron, Meg Ryan, and Tom Hanks, thank you for creating my all-time favorite movie, You've Got Mail. It's the best and always lifts me up when I'm down. It's a perfect Christmas movie, but also works great as fall viewing or at the start of spring. Really, it's a year-round movie. I'll probably go watch it right after we're done here. Finally, thank you all for listening to this. I would send you each a bouquet of newly sharpened pencils if I had your addresses. I'm overwhelmed with gratitude, but enough about me. XOXO Danny. P.S. H-A-G-S Hags. Have a great summer. This is Danny Pellegrino. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of How Do I Unremember This? Unfortunately, True Stories. This program was directed by Richard Brewer, executive producer Nick Martorelli, edited by Chris Howerton, text copyright 2022 by Danny Pellegrino. Production copyright 2022, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.